Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong from Neuroscience and Molecular Biology and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
Well, it's nice to be back, Sam. I hope my sound is okay. I'm here through a phone line in the New York Historical Society. But this is a conversation we couldn't wait to have. It's been a really big week in American politics. The last time that we spoke was before the hearings had begun. Since we have talked, the nation has been really shocked, riveted, and in the middle of really a historic debate over Judge Kavanaugh, who testified along with Dr. Ford about the accusations of sexual assault. And since the hearings, after the Judiciary Committee moved forward with the nomination, Senator Flake called for an investigation. And in the last few days, as we record this, the FBI is conducting some kind of investigation, although we're not sure the extent of it, the nature of it. That itself has become another question, and stories are opening up almost daily in the press about more on Judge Kavanaugh's background and other accusations that have emerged and contradictions with the testimony that he told under oath. So we don't know where this is all going. We're recording this on Tuesday. We're very fortunate to have a terrific guest with us today, Marcy Wheeler, who's an independent journalist who's based out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, who focuses primarily on issues of national security and privacy, which we might get to in the middle of this conversation. She's written for many publications, including The Guardian, The Huffington Post, and more. And most importantly, she operates a phenomenal blog called Empty Wheel, which many people turn to on a regular basis to try to make some sense of what's going on. She's also the author of Anatomy of Deceit, How the Bush Administration Used the Media to Sell the Iraq War. Marcy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me. This is great.
So maybe we can just start with getting your thoughts on what this investigation is, if it's actually some kind of investigation, since Senator Flake had that encounter in the elevator. What's your perspective on how this is being handled post-Judiciary Committee vote? Do you sense this is going to produce any kind of the political dynamics on the Hill, or what do you think of the actual investigation / background check from what you know?
Well, let's take a step back and talk about what it really is. And it really is a process by which Trump and the Republicans are trying to get the votes of, you mentioned Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Manchin. And those are kind of the swing votes. If two of them, three of them vote against Kavanaugh, he will not be confirmed. And at the beginning, there was a sense that Flake did this. Flake is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he was persuaded to do it by Chris Coons, who's a Democrat. Flake did this to give himself and the two other Republicans, Manchin's a Democrat, the two other Republicans more cover to vote for Kavanaugh. But the big question is what we're investigating here. I mean, we are clearly investigating at least two sexual assaults, one against Dr. Ford back in high school, 1982, and the other one, Kavanaugh allegedly exposing himself to a Yale co-student when they were freshmen. But we're also, I mean, that is tied up with questions of Kavanaugh's completely unbelievable testimony last Thursday, where he claimed to address just Dr. Ford's allegations, and in the process raised a lot more questions about his suitability to be a judge, or to be a justice. We can get back to whether he should even be an appellate court judge, but and so that's the issue, because I think there is increasing amounts of corroboration, especially for Debbie Ramirez's, the former Yale student's allegations about these events. But what comes along with that is an increasing proof that Kavanaugh lied about sex, right? Lied about whether he had sex, whether he was a blackout drunk, whether he did certain things with his buddies when he was 18. And that, I think, should bring us back to questions about whether he lied about warrantless wiretapping and torture and using stolen emails and his own judicial record and so on and so forth. But that's where we're at. Ironically, for a guy who was on the Ken Starr investigation and was the one who pushed questioning Bill Clinton about sex very aggressively, his character will be measured in terms of whether it is fairly compellingly proven that he's been lying about sex.
It's funny. He also wrote an op-ed that I recently saw again in the Washington Post. He co-wrote it in 99, praising Ken Starr and what they had done. And he slams Richard Cohen, who wrote an article criticizing Starr. And one of the points he makes is that Clinton has no one to blame other than himself, Bill Clinton back then, President Clinton, for perjuring himself. And that no one compelled him to do that. And he makes a very strong case on that front. So it's interesting now to see a very different reaction from him and obviously from the Republicans. Can I ask you one question? Can you just tell us who he was in terms of national security issues, such as questions of torture? Where did he fit in that Bush administration? I'm sure everyone really knows who he was outside of the Ken Starr report and who he is right now.
Right. So he was first in the White House counsel's office, and in some early discussions about what I'll broadly call the Patriot Act, but the early discussions immediately after 9/11 on how to respond legally. And then he became staff secretary, which meant all of the paperwork that went to the president came over his desk. And that's pertinent during the period of the passage of the Detainee Treatment Act, which was John McCain's effort to rein in torture in 2005, for which President Bush signed a fairly aggressive signing statement exempting large parts of the government from that law. So those are two actions on surveillance and on torture where his claims have not borne out now that we've gotten more of his record.
So in various testimony to the Senate, where the nation is focused on issues of drunkenness and sexual assault dating back to his teens and early college years. Yet, substantively, it seems as a public figure, there are all these things he's done as staff secretary, working in the White House counsel's office. It appears that we don't have access to any of that. Yet, presumably, the Republicans in that room were in one way or another knowledgeable or complicit in those things. So it feels like there's a big elephant in the room of events that many of them know about and we are not hearing about. So what's your perspective on what has leaked out based on what's available publicly?
Well, that's why I think the most, aside from the sexual assault allegations, which are very serious, and which he is stumbling all over himself lying about. So, I mean, they're serious and he's being caught in blatant lies. And those two together, I think, are very toxic for him. But I think the lie, aside from his judicial record, which is critically important because he's lying about things like Roe and investigating the president. But aside from that, which should be the substantive issue, I think the lie that is most crucial is whether or not he was in the loop when a Senate Judiciary Committee staffer, an Orrin Hatch staffer named Manuel Miranda, was stealing Democratic correspondence on judicial nominees in 2002 and 2003 and sharing them with Brett Kavanaugh. So effectively what Miranda was doing is what the Russians were doing with Hillary Clinton, but what Miranda was doing was stealing Democratic strategy discussions about very controversial right-wing judges who were coming before SJC to be confirmed, and sharing it with the White House, including, we now know, with Brett Kavanaugh. And Kavanaugh, in both of his confirmation processes to become a circuit court judge, had been asked about that and had denied any knowledge of it. And some of the documents that were liberated in the process of his confirmation this time around make it very clear that he was in the loop. He was getting documents labeled spying and getting draft op-eds written by Patrick Leahy before they were public, so that Republicans were already working to counter Leahy op-eds ahead of time. And that's important for a couple reasons. One is because he lied in his last two confirmation hearings, because he lied about a topic which is critically important right now, which is what happens when somebody advances their political stance by using stolen emails. In this case, it was just a staffer who stole them. But of course, Trump used emails stolen from Hillary Clinton, stolen by the Russian government. So, you know, that's what the Supreme Court may have to review in the next couple of months. And the thing that bothers me the most about it is, you know, Kavanaugh claims, oh, I had no idea I was getting emails labeled spying. I had no idea that was based on spying. But even if he's telling the truth, let's pretend for the moment he's telling the truth. He learned in this confirmation process for the first time, if he's telling the truth, that he was using stolen emails back in 2003, 2002. And the normal response of a decent human being, having learned for the first time that they had benefited from stolen goods, right, would be sort of embarrassment, would be, oh my gosh, Patrick Leahy, you know, all these years I've been denying that. I had no idea that your suspicions were actually justified. I'm sorry. That's what you would do if you were a decent human being. But Kavanaugh did none of that, right? Kavanaugh was just like, forget it, man. I did nothing. You can't accuse me of that. Let's move on. And that, I think, should have been one of the first signals that his character really is not appropriate to be confirmed for the Supreme Court, because he didn't even feign embarrassment about being caught using stolen emails.
But these things are all, again, I'm just trying to put myself inside the heads of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. These facts are known to them because they were up to their eyeballs in it, and it was a big deal to them at the time. And so I'm wondering, even if these things were being dragged out in the way that these lurid stories about his youth, a few, you know, before that, even if these were being discussed now, what would be the reaction? Wouldn't the reaction be, yeah, whatever, you Democrats are whining about something that happened 15 years ago? Like, why, you know, what would be the reaction even if we were having that conversation today?
Right. I mean, Orrin Hatch is not going to condemn Kavanaugh for something that his staffer did, right? I mean, many of these committees are full of such old senators. There are a few younger ones on this committee, and thankfully on the Democratic side, there's a lot of new blood. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, who I think really invigorated the confirmation process. But Orrin Hatch is not going to discredit Judge Kavanaugh for having basically been in a conspiracy with him and his
right.
staffer. And that's one of the undertones to this. One of the things that happened is that Ed Whelan, who for some reason is considered, he was on an ethics NGO, a legal NGO, and he basically accused an old Kavanaugh buddy of assault. He said, oh no, it's this guy who did the assault against Dr. Ford, not Judge Kavanaugh. He basically accused an innocent person of assault, of sexual assault, as a way to get Judge Kavanaugh off the hook. And what's interesting about this is I almost feel like you're dealing with the Trump White House, which is notoriously bad at vetting and doesn't really care if it hires people who are corrupt. You've got Don McGahn, who this should be his last confirmation process because he's being ousted for testifying to Robert Mueller, but who his singularly best achievement as White House counsel has been packing the courts with these, you know, far right Republican judges. And you've got Judge Kavanaugh himself, who has a long history. I mean, when he was in the White House, he was the Don McGahn. He was the Ed Whelan. He was the guy doing all this dirty work to make sure far-right judges were confirmed. And I almost feel like that's a toxic mix because Kavanaugh, I mean, one of the latest allegations NBC reporting overnight is that Kavanaugh and his people were already talking to Yale students, to former Yale, colleagues, about the Ramirez allegation before it was public. So they knew where to go. Mm-hmm. They knew who to silence. they knew what kind of evidence they needed to collect to have in hand for when that allegation came forward. And then Kavanaugh went to Orrin Hatch and swore under oath that he didn't know about that allegation until it became public in The New Yorker. So basically, Kavanaugh was doing his own oppo work because that's his forte. That's what he did back in 2002 and 2003 when he was benefiting from stolen emails. And that may be the thing that sinks him.
So it's almost like, I mean, if I'm just laying these things out on a timeline, we talk about this business with Manuel Miranda and obtaining stolen information from the Judiciary Committee in 2002. That's now 16 years ago. And then a couple of decades before that, there he is in high school with the story that we're hearing about Christine Blasey, also things he did at Yale. He's a self-admitted, heavy partying drunk at Yale Law School. And he's on record as making a public speech about it, proud of it. So I'm getting this feeling that actually this is just all one continuous story. And in some sense, we're getting a pretty continuous picture of him over the last 35 years. And, maybe he doesn't, we don't know whether he gets blackout drunk anymore. One would guess probably not, almost certainly not. But it feels like it's a continuous portrait of someone maturing decade by decade. And one can almost imagine that it's basically the same person the whole time. It's just what that kind of guy grows up into. Like, what would be your take on what we know so far?
Well, I think his response to all of this is the response of Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, the other key moment, and I sort of mentioned this, but is the Ken Starr investigation, right? So he was right. The guy who insisted on going to the president, and I'm going to read a quote. He wrote a memo to Ken Starr, and he said, "I'm strongly opposed to giving the president any break in the questioning regarding the details of the Lewinsky relationship." This is Monica Lewinsky, with whom Clinton had an affair inside the Oval Office. Regarding the details of the Lewinsky relationship, unless before questioning on Monday, he either one, resigns, or two, confesses perjury and issues a public apology to you, you being Ken Starr, who subsequently covered up sexual assault at Baylor University. And then he went on to pose the questions
Kenneth
that
Starr
became...
Did that.
Kavanaugh, yeah. But Ken Starr has, vouched for Kavanaugh's character, for what that means. And then Brett Kavanaugh in 1998 laid out a series of questions that were crazy, this is how cable news got made, because he forced the president under oath to answer questions about oral sex, about using cigars as sex toys, about et cetera, et cetera. And so that Brett Kavanaugh is the Brett Kavanaugh who was asked very similar questions under oath in his confirmation hearing to be on the Supreme Court. And his response was not apparently to tell the truth. It was to do precisely what he believed was an impeachable offense 20 years ago. It was to tell, kind of embarrassing lies, but very, he was trying to kind of bulldoze his way through with arrogance. And if he gets in, then it worked for him. And it is horrific that 20-year span has succeeded in kind of the heights of hypocrisy, right? Because according to 1998, Brett Kavanaugh, what Brett Kavanaugh did last Thursday is an impeachable offense, not just for Supreme Court, but I'd say even for the circuit. But if he doesn't succeed, then it's sort of the ultimate moral story. I don't know.
The other interesting storyline of this is the FBI, which we've been following, obviously, in a very different context, and its ongoing conflict with the administration. And James Comey wrote this op-ed in the New York Times that has also been the center of debate. What's your impression of the state of the FBI in the last few days? How it's handling this, how this might impact the body after what's gone on in the past few months, and Comey's op-ed itself. I'm curious what your thoughts were.
I try not to get too hung up on Comey op-eds, just because I was very smart in 2013 when I said that Democrats would regret confirming Comey with almost no scrutiny to be FBI director, and I stand by that. Look, I think this is where the FBI under Robert Mueller has been unbelievably sealed up. right? So in spite of, you know, there were leaks, but some of those leaks came from people closer to Trump. In the transition period, there were leaks from Congress, from the CIA, from people in the vicinity of FBI, but probably not, you know, probably not FBI agents directly. And as soon as the investigation of Trump got moved on to Robert Mueller, all that shut down. I mean, that just like, wow, you know, nothing's getting out of that. But the FBI continues to be a really leaky body. And so when they were tasked last week to conduct an investigation, which was not really an investigation, it leaked. And meanwhile, all of the witnesses who knew they should be witnesses were going to the press, and that's their right, right? You know, all of these people around Debbie Ramirez saying, no one's calling us, and we've got the goods. And so we're back to that scenario where when the FBI is not getting what it needs to conduct a credible investigation, the public finds out about it. Trump is getting some pressure. Those four moderates that I talked about, the swing votes, are in a position where they can demand a real investigation. And it's unclear to what degree they're actually demanding that. But they're in the position where they can make demands on McConnell and on Trump. And so maybe we will get a halfway credible investigation. And if not, we'll get stories like the NBC one where it becomes clear. I mean, NBC has text messages making it clear, it sounds like, that Kavanaugh lied under oath to that question from Orrin Hatch, with whom he's conspired to get far-right judicial nominees through the process before, about whether or not he knew about the Ramirez allegations before they became public.
Do you think it's possible for an aggressive investigation that turns up material to actually change the political dynamics on the Hill? The cynic in me agrees with those who say it won't matter. You know, it will be spun and twisted in whatever direction suits the purposes of Senator McConnell. But do you think, I'm open to being wrong, can an investigation of this sort still have weight if the evidence is, you know, shocking enough or damaging enough on face value?
Well, I mean, again, it comes down to those four votes. And so the vote is close enough. And, you know, Collins historically will use any excuse she can find to vote with her party. Murkowski, there's a dynamic that people are not really paying attention to with Murkowski, which is that she did not win as a Republican. She won as an independent.
Right. And she's a write-in.
Yeah, she's a write-in.
People and had to spell Murkowski. And, you know, they had to write, or you know what I mean.
I mean, that's like spelling dingle in Southeast Michigan. It's sort of one of the first things you learn. but she won, very importantly, with the Native American vote. And one of the things, you know, Chris Coons got a lot of plaudits for the deal he made with Flake last week. But one of the people who's been unbelievable in this confirmation process is Mazie Hirono. And she, very early on, was asking Kavanaugh questions that most people didn't understand. But she was like, tell me about your treatment of Hawaiian tribes. You don't think they should get Native tribal rights. And she kept hammering it. And it got very little attention, you know, because most people don't think about tribal rights and that kind of legal background. But that's critically important for Alaskans. Same issue. Do Native Alaskans get tribal rights? And there is a great degree of pressure on Murkowski for that reason. It has nothing to do with Roe, has nothing to do with sexual assault, has nothing to do with... And Murkowski's already in a position where she didn't win with her party last time. She won with Alaskans who can spell Murkowski. And so Murkowski is a vote that I think people are kind of ignoring. And I've even heard of one or two other Republicans who are not being attended to very closely. But yeah, otherwise it comes down to Flank Manchin and Collins and the perennial question of whether Collins is going to pull the football away like she always does.
Right.
And it might. I mean, the pressure here and Kavanaugh is not a likable person. I think, you know, his polling... Sam, talk to me about this. Tell me about the polling.
Right? I believe that his favorability for his confirmation has dropped, I think, 7 points in the last week, which is kind of a lot. I mean, it's not a popularity contest through polling, but it is also the fact that measures public opinion. So let me thinking about this in terms of the focus on these four senators, we're watching this big drama, and evidently some of these things like leaking information from Manny Miranda doesn't matter. But if we're viewing this through the lens of what do these four senators think? We just went through Murkowski's, you know, looking after Alaskan interests in the way that she does so with such energy. What about all these things with the alcohol and the drunkenness? I mean, now maybe I'm just being excessively naive, but you know, Flake is from a state with a Mormon population. There is some claim to morality on the Republican side, and so if we hear about this, these drunken antics, are they just youthful hijinks, or is that a thing that will work with Flake? Like, what's going through his mind? I wonder.
Well, the other ironic thing is SJC, in a bizarrely unrepresentative manner, has four Mormons on it. So in addition to Flake, Crapo, Hatch, and Lee, all Mormons. And so the men who are voting on whether or not women have access to reproductive rights are overwhelmingly Mormon. So I don't, you know, it's obviously not going to make a difference with Hatch. It doesn't seem to be making a difference with Crapo. It doesn't seem to be making a difference with Lee, who, unlike the other two, does have certain principles that he holds dear. I guess sobriety is not one of them. I don't think it's the drunkenness that matters. And I mean, in spite of the fact that it was illegal drinking for most of the incidents in question, I don't think that's the issue. Although I think
that's a common crime.
It's a common crime. And it's not, I mean, I'm guilty of the same. I'm never going to be Supreme Court justice, but I'm, you know, like you can find terrible stories about me drinking in college. I promise you.
Next episode.
But a lot of other people too, right? But I think it's the lying about it, right?
Yeah.
And it does raise questions about his ongoing relationship. And there are even in the documents from the White House, there was one where he talked about going out with buddies and not remembering it. There, on the sexual assault and sexual impropriety allegations, one of the things that I keep coming back to is that he was asked in the hearing by, I think, Mazie Hirono, did you receive any of Judge Kaczynski? Alex Kaczynski had to step down for sexual harassment and for sending really inappropriate emails among his people. And Kavanaugh was one of his mentees. So obvious question, were you aware of Alex Kaczynski's really egregious sexual harassment? Can you look in your emails and find out? And he kind of dodged that question, as he's very good at doing. And then in the questions for the record, Leahy said, can you please go look at your emails and see whether you received any of these sexually explicit emails from Judge Kaczynski? And he didn't do it. He just said, I don't remember. And so I assume from that he did receive those totally inappropriate emails. And that says until recently, possibly until last year, he was still a part of this culture of degradation of women, even while, you know, he hired all these women to be his clerks. He still found it appropriate to make jokes at the expense of women. And so, you know, I don't think it's a question of whether somebody drank a lot in college. He did, I did, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm unfit or fit now, but he does show some continuity of these issues and really a continuity of this frat boy culture, which then translates into things like Garza, into things like denying a 17-year-old rape victim the ability to get an abortion in timely fashion. And then I think, you know, that's where I would love to see this conversation go, which is that the man who exposed himself to Debbie Ramirez as a freshman in college, allegedly, is clearly the man who says a 17-year-old rape victim cannot choose to terminate a pregnancy without jumping through all sorts of hoops, you know, at the behest of a male judge.
We are almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you one question, different issue about what you do and how you do it. You have a website that's really high quality. It's really made an impact, and it's a current version of the blog, which is really front and center. There's all these debates about where journalism is going and the challenges it faces. How do you think about what you're doing with Empty Wheel and how you want to maintain it in this era to produce the best kind of coverage of political events? I know that's a big question, but I'm just curious as the founder and organizer of this, how you think about your work with Empty Wheel.
Right, I'm old school. I'm like the one person who never left the aughts blogging culture. No, I mean, what I do is very document intensive. It's not just documents, but and it's very, one of the things that I find when I work, and I do sometimes work with, you know, journalists whose forte is camping out outside somebody's house and getting people to answer you on the records. And I can do that, but it's not my forte, and I don't have the funding to go sit outside somebody's house and you know, ask them questions aggressively. But one of the things I think that journalism often loses or often lacks in this focus on human sources, and always has, it's better than it used to be, but still suffers from it, is that if you only get information from human beings, it's a lot easier to spin you. And as an example, Rachel Mitchell, who was the Senate Judiciary Republicans, hired a sex crimes prosecutor from Arizona to do the questioning of Ford, and they thought maybe she could question Kavanaugh until it became clear that she was finding incriminating information.
She's actually finding stuff out.
And then they brought Lindsey Graham in to, like, you know, rage again and change the tactic. But so she released a report, and the report was ridiculous. I mean, the report was utterly silent of her three rounds of questioning of Judge Kavanaugh, including that she found a party that resembled the one that Dr. Ford described as the one at which she was assaulted. So she basically said, let me see if Dr. Ford is credible, and let me ignore all of the ways in which, in my just three rounds, my very abbreviated questioning of Judge Kavanaugh, he was not. And the report was released, and you know, in typical fashion, it was published as saying the report says X, Y, and Z. And any basic analysis of the report very quickly got to this report is bogus. I mean, this report is ridiculous. This report ignores the questions of Kavanaugh. It ignores that Mitchell asked each person about to assess their own credibility very differently. And in fact, Kavanaugh probably comes off worse than Dr. Ford, even on the unbalanced terms. And so I think there still is that necessity in journalism to both, one thing I do on the Russian investigation is I've done these narratives of what are the questions that Mueller is known to want to ask the president. What do they say about the investigation? And that tells you more at this point, frankly, than Rudy Giuliani in 17 ridiculous interviews will ever tell you.
Right. So you read the documents and you see what Mueller has done in previous filings. So you're talking about those documents.
And also, I mean, the New York Times is very funny because Mike Schmidt was given a list of questions that Jay Sekulow, one of the president's lawyers, put together as a prep document for the interview that will never happen. And the questions were really remarkable in that, they laid out a whole basic timeline of how Mueller is thinking of it as interpreted through Jay Sekulow. But they also, a third of the questions, even back in March, were about conspiracy with Russia. And in spite of being the one who published those set of questions, Mike Schmidt continues to believe that the president is only being investigated for obstruction because Rudy Giuliani tells him over and over and over and over, and over again that he's only being investigated for obstruction. And so, there's just, because of the centrality on human sources in much, not all, but much reporting, particularly in, news cycle driven news, that kind of assessment of the credibility of witnesses goes by the wayside. And on the Russian investigation, I really started doing this full time when I did the Libby investigation, the CIA leak investigation in 2003 to 2007. And it was a similar thing, right? You've got these very high-powered lawyers representing very high-powered clients, And it's very easy to spin a story if only certain kinds of defendants tell the story and others remain silent. And, you know, that creates not news, it creates a story. And there are places to find more news, but they're not necessarily by talking to the witnesses who are willing to talk to you.
Well, as a historian, I certainly appreciate your approach to covering this, and I think it's incredibly valuable.
But I also worked in business documentation for however you count, up to 10 years. So two things. I worked in business bureaucratic documents for 10 years, and I worked in academics for 7, 8, doing archival work at the PhD level. So.
I see. So history, comparative literature, documents work. You focus on documents. That's your record. I'm feeling this, you know, weird nerdy kinship, because when I look at polling data, look, these are numbers that get measured. And I know that we have all these kinds of noises that we make about what's going on in the news, but there's a number that we can look at. And, you know, maybe the number's right, maybe the number's wrong, but at least somebody made a measurement. And so the fact that you look at this documentation just is, as you say, very different from human sources.
The corporate work I used to do is the kind of job that journalists go to when they want to start making money. I did the opposite. but in those circumstances, you basically get a project and they're like, okay, here are your two subject matter experts, and here is a box of documents that you can work from. And if you're talking about a bureaucratic process, that's fine, because documents really do tell bureaucratic processes to some degree. But that is, I guess, why I'm comfortable with the balance that I have now. It's not that I don't talk to human beings. It's that I start from the documents, because that's what I learned both getting a PhD and, you know, working in these big corporations from boxes of documents, and, you know, being able to run stuff by people once in a while. I think those are the skill sets, and it is. Similar kind of work to what I did on newspapers in 19th century France, Czechoslovakia, and Argentina. Czechoslovakia wasn't a country. But.
Fortunately, we're out of time, and I just want to thank our guest again, Marcy Wheeler, who is the person who runs and founded Empty Wheel, which is a terrific site. I urge everyone to read it, to follow it. And she's also the author of Anatomy of Deceit, How the Bush Administration Used the Media to Sell the Iraq War. Thanks for joining our show.
Awesome to be on. Thanks.
Once again, thanks, everyone. And you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.